You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up on the program, federal disability recipients in Wisconsin have run into barriers trying to access pandemic unemployment benefits. We'll talk to a WPR reporter about his recent investigation into this issue. First, we all run into words we haven't heard before, and when they don't actually make sense, we put them in a category of gibberish, gobbledygook, word salad. Gibberish has a long history, from made-up languages in 12th century Germany all the way to scat singing in jazz music. But sometimes people use that gibberish label to describe and even demean words used by people from cultures that are different from their own. Jenny Nuttall is a lecturer in medieval English literature at Exeter College in the University of Oxford. She recently wrote a piece about the history of gibberish for Eon. Jenny, thanks for joining us.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. Thanks for breaking this down for us. You write that people who study language love to track down the origins of words, so we should start with the word gibberish. Where does it come from?
Well, it's just got 100 years older because it was originally thought that it came into English in the 16th century, and the lexicographers at the Middle English Dictionary have found an example from the middle of the 15th century. We probably think, we're not sure, it's one of those words that has a kind of mysterious origin, but we think it might come from verbs that we find slightly later, like gobble and gabber and jabber and gab. So if you think of England having the language of English, gibber has the language of gibberish, or those who gibber speak gibberish. So it's a kind of imitation of what hearing someone talking nonsense, unintelligible sound might be.
And that is how we use it now. Has it always meant the same thing?
Not really. And I got interested in it now because it's used so often as a kind of pejorative. But it's used now, I think, to mean language which does actually make sense, although it might be difficult or slightly incoherent. But it's used now to mean language that we don't like for some reason. We think it's too technical, or we think the person doesn't know what they're talking about. Back in its earliest meaning, it does literally mean its more precise meaning, which is language that you just cannot understand. And in the first example of the word gibberish in English, it's used to describe what it's like if you kind of say your prayers without paying attention, if you mumble your prayers under your breath. And the author says, well, that's like talking gibberish to God, and goes on to say it's like talking a mixture of English and French, which were the two languages commonly spoken in medieval England. It's like a kind of impossible mixture of those two things. So I think the older meaning is more accurate, and nowadays we tend to fling it around to put other groups down, as you were saying.
Sure. So I don't like what someone else is saying, or I don't think that their point is valid. So that's when I slap the label of gibberish on it and just say, well, that doesn't make any sense. More in a theoretical aspect instead of with the precision of where the word came from.
Yes, I think that's right.
You write that there's this issue in there about who is who, what gibberish is, depending on what is considered mainstream culture and who's an outsider. How does that play out in the way that we talk about people not making sense?
Yes, and I think you find gibberish, particularly in the 16th century, connected with groups of immigrants into England, with the Romani, for example, the gypsy culture, also in expressions like double Dutch, which is a way of saying that you can't understand what someone's saying. And you find it as a label for people speaking their own language, again, language that makes perfect sense, but perhaps in a cultural context where it's not understood. And that connection between outsiders and the language they speak goes all the way back into that word barbarian, barbarous, which was explained in Greek as imitating the sound that people who didn't speak Greek, who spoke other languages, made. So they made sounds like animals like sheep, perhaps, bah, bah, bah. So we've always used ideas of talking gibberish and words that can kind of imitate how the sound of the speaker of another language sounds to us, to kind of notice that difference. And in the Renaissance, particularly in the theatre, there's lots of references to it's all Greek to me, it's double Dutch, double Hebrew, talking Welsh. People seem, the English always seem very aware of other languages they're hearing that they find funny or difficult.
Right. And labeling them other, because we also use gobbledygook words like that to describe maybe different words that people who are experts use, or different professions or social classes. We categorize them like this.
Yes. And I mean, a word like jargon has an interesting history. It starts off as a French word for bird song, actually, but then becomes a way of describing kind of people chattering very fast, people using technical terms. It becomes a word for slang. And now jargon, I think, like gobbledygook, like gibberish, serves this function of being able to say, I don't understand it. And rather than sort of acknowledging that you don't understand something or you don't like it, there's a useful label. But what I'm really interested in is it's often not literally gibberish. Gibberish in its pure form is not words at all, just kind of representations on the page of sounds and things that look like words. And most of the time, gibberish, jargon, slang is perfectly functioning language to someone's ear. It's just we choose not to see it that way.
Jenny Nuttall is a lecturer in medieval English literature at Exeter College at the University of Oxford. And we're talking about gibberish, nonsensical language, and what we really mean when we say that. Jenny, there are some instances, though, right, of people intentionally making up words that just don't make a lot of sense.
Yes, and that has a really long history in English. So if you go back to Old English, the language spoken in England before the Norman Conquest, you find medical remedies. They're a sort of cross between a treatment and a spell. And some of these remedies, they're written or copied down in about the year 1000. And some of them have words from foreign languages, Latin or Hebrew. But some of them have little stretches of absolute pure gibberish. And scholars study them, but can't make any sense of it. And what we've gradually realized is that they're gibberish, but used in a kind of positive, beneficial way, perhaps like a packet of pills with a really fancy name that you don't understand. And if you said one of these old charms to yourself with the gibberish word, you would feel like the words were doing you good. So I think gibberish does have a kind of potentially kind of healing, playful, reassuring capacity. We sing gibberish quite a lot when we're happy, kind of folk songs, and you know, when we're improvising, and we often use kind of gibberish sounds when we're singing and playing with babies and children. So I'm interested in what is actually real gibberish, not the kind of the language we label as gibberish, but the real gibberish that seems to want to break through in the world around us in all sorts of interesting ways.
Well, and one of the most obvious examples of that is in music when it comes to jazz. How should we think about how gibberish is worked into music?
Well, it has an interesting name. They're called non-lexical vocables. And you could think of it emerging perhaps when the human voice is imitating an instrument and improvising alongside other instruments. And it's easier perhaps to do that not using the lyrics of a song, but the kind of using the voice as a musical instrument. And that has a long tradition. You find these non-lexical vocables, these sung sounds, which are not conventional words, in folk singing and all the way back through Tudor songs with Hey Nonny Nonny and Hey Trolley Lolly, and all the way back into medieval carols and lullabies.
What about what drives us to make up words that don't have full languages, that don't have decipherable meanings? Where does that come from?
Oh, God. I mean, you find gibberish in so many different places. I mean, sometimes it can be useful. We can test children's in Britain. Children get their reading ability, their ability to decode phonetics at an early age tested by being given gibberish words, and the teachers tell them that they're the names of aliens, and please can the kids read the names of aliens. I think it's always the kind of other side of the coin of our language ability in a way. We spend such a lot of time as babies and children and then adults making sense. But that in some ways is a kind of conscious decision, because we know playfully or usefully we can turn off the making sense bit of our language and just enjoy the sounds, whether it's singing or play, or it can be high art, it can be kind of sound poetry, modernist sound poetry. It's because it gives us our language in some sense. It's always there for us to use if we want to.
And then we can take those sounds, and sometimes, you know, is there potential that they become real words that we use and that eventually carry meaning?
Oh, that's an interesting question. I mean, I think some of those words, so, you know, the words that are half gibberish in a poem like Lewis Carroll's The Jabberwocky have become kind of almost words. And I think there are particularly onomatopoeic words where we're imitating sound in language, you know, whoosh or mush or those kind of words. Those start off as kind of imitative sounds and then eventually find their way into the dictionary. And a word like lullaby, those two parts of the word lullaby are made from two sounds that you find in medieval carols that describe how the Virgin Mary sang to the infant Christ. And she sings in the medieval carols words or non-lexical vocables like lula and bye-bye, the sort of noises you might sing to a baby. And that becomes our word lullaby.
Yeah. Jenny, thank you so much for breaking this down for us.
Thank you.
Jenny Nuttall is a lecturer in medieval English literature at Exeter College at the University of Oxford. You're listening to Central Time. Thanks for being with us on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. Coming up, President Trump left the White House this week for a photo op at a Washington, D.C. church. And to do that, law enforcement cleared peaceful protesters out of the way with tear gas. We'll find out more about how the incident played out from an NPR White House reporter ahead. Now, the federal government's response to the coronavirus pandemic included funding for unemployment assistance for people who wouldn't otherwise qualify. But as Bram Sablesmith reports, a group of about 175,000 Wisconsinites isn't eligible for that relief.
In March, when the coronavirus pandemic came and Americans stopped traveling, Jessica Barrera was laid off from the airport shuttle service where she worked in Eau Claire.
And I also had my 10-year-old who was home and there wasn't childcare, because he would do before and after school with the Y or the Boys and Girls Club, which closed.
So Barrera did what nearly 70,000 other Wisconsinites did that third week of March, filed her first weekly unemployment claim. She filed another claim the next week, and the next, and so on, until finally she received a letter from the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development saying all of her claims were denied.
I cried for days because I thought that was going to be my saving grace to help me to get by.
Barrera has a rare blood disorder called polycythemia vera. Her body produces too many red blood cells. It's caused her to have strokes, blood clots, and miscarriages, among other complications.
So about once a month, they take 16 ounces of blood out of me and just throw it away.
She also has depression and anxiety stemming from family tragedies. All of that qualifies her for Social Security Disability Insurance, or SSDI. It's a federally funded program for people who have worked and paid Social Security taxes but can no longer earn a significant income. Through SSDI, Barrera gets a small monthly check and qualifies for Medicare health insurance, even though she's only 40. But what she didn't realize...
Wisconsin has this strange thing that doesn't exist in any other state but North Carolina, which says that if you get SSDI benefits, you don't get any regular unemployment.
Victor Forberger is a labor and employment attorney in Madison who is helping Barrera. The law barring unemployment help for people on SSDI was passed in 2013. The rationale at the time was that people who received both were double dipping in assistance and potentially committing fraud.
I think it's discriminatory. I disagree with it, but it's what the legislature passed.
But what's really surprising to Forberger is that the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development is also denying pandemic unemployment assistance to people on SSDI. The pandemic assistance was created under the Federal Stimulus Act passed in March that expanded access to unemployment.
The law specifically says those who are ineligible for regular unemployment benefits under state law are entitled to pandemic unemployment assistance.
And yet that help is being denied to people on SSDI, like Jessica Barrera. A spokesperson for the department said the pandemic assistance guidance issued by the federal government does not have specific language for Wisconsin's unusual ban on SSDI and unemployment. And where there is an absence of clear language, they've been directed by the feds to follow state rules for regular unemployment. Forberger is skeptical.
That's meant to apply to kind of procedural issues, like how long do you have to file an appeal?
138 SSDI recipients have been denied unemployment since March, but the state does not know how many of its 175,000 SSDI beneficiaries were denied pandemic assistance. Forberger is helping about 20 appeal denied claims, but he says that process could take months in an overwhelmed unemployment system. The state has received more than 2.4 million unemployment claims since March. Jessica Barrera couldn't wait. She found a new job that starts this week, which also means finding childcare during a pandemic. It's a frustrating situation.
So if somebody else worked the same hours, same wages as me, they could get unemployment if they weren't on SSDI.
And that, Barrera says, almost feels like discrimination. Bram Sablesmith, Wisconsin Public Radio.
You're listening to the Ideas Network. The story we just heard comes from a partnership between Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Watch. Bram Sablesmith is covering the topic. Bram, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
We just heard your story. Why is it that this issue of Wisconsin's laws is coming up now? I mean, it's been in place since 2013.
That's right. The issue is that, you know, the federal government, as part of the CARES Act, which is the federal stimulus for this pandemic, they issued new unemployment insurance that is specifically designated to be offered to, among other people, people who are not covered under normal state unemployment insurance. And so theoretically, that would cover these people who are on Social Security disability insurance. But because of Wisconsin's law banning people from collecting SSDI and unemployment at the same time, as well as a lack of federal guidance on what to do about this specific situation that seems to be only here in Wisconsin and possibly North Carolina, the state is also denying this new pandemic unemployment assistance to people. So that's a pool of 175,000, you know, working age people in Wisconsin who are just, you know, completely ineligible from getting assistance, unemployment assistance during, you know, the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression.
You cite that number. You also cite the number of denied claims. How do you find that information and also verify it, make sure that it's true?
Right. Well, there's a federal database on the number of people in each state who are who collect Social Security disability insurance. It's about 175,000 people in Wisconsin, and they're all working age. You know, once you turn 65, if you're on SSDI, it turns into normal Social Security payments. In terms of the number of denied claims, we reached out to the Wisconsin Department of Workforce Development. They're the ones who quoted us the number of 138 people who have been denied normal state uninsurance claims because they're on SSDI. They did not have a number of people who have been denied this federal pandemic unemployment assistance because they're on SSDI. But one thing to consider is that, you know, after Wisconsin passed this law barring people from collecting SSDI and unemployment at the same time in 2013, you know, over the next 2 years, the state declined or denied 3,500 claims of people who were seeking unemployment assistance. So, it, you know, even in good times, that was a really good economic times. Even in good times, a lot of people can be denied unemployment claims this way.
These regulations, these interpretations, they affect real people's lives. I mean, what do you want people to realize about those who are affected by these regulations?
Well, you know, I spoke to the main character of my story, Jessica Barrera, the 40-year-old woman in Eau Claire. And she, you know, she makes this point that like she's paying taxes, you know, in order to qualify for Social Security disability insurance, you have to have a certain amount of work history, and that includes, you know, paying Social Security taxes and all of that. You know, it's a pot that she's paying into. She's also, you know, a taxpayer for the federal government as well. And so it just, to her, it really does feel like discrimination that, you know, somebody who works the same number of hours as she does, somebody who is in the exact same situation as her, can get unemployment help in this, you know, this really drastic economic crisis that we're in. And it's only because that she's on disability insurance through no fault of her own that she's not able to collect it. And to her, that seems really unfair.
Bram, how does this story fit into your broader reporting during COVID-19?
Well, you know, it's part of our responsibilities as reporters and investigative reporters to really be surfacing the stories of people who may be having a hard time getting their voices raised. You know, this is a brand new story for me that I didn't know anything about, but you know, these are real people who are being impacted in this time right now, and it's something that can be changed. That I think that's a really big takeaway. I mean, in order for someone like Jessica Barrera to be able to collect unemployment insurance, all it would take, you know, potentially the legislature could change this rule during the pandemic in the same way that they waived the 1 week waiting period to get unemployment insurance, which is another state law. I mean, there's actionable things that could happen from this. And so we're just helping people raise their voices about the concerns they're going through and the realities of their lives during the pandemic.
Bram, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
That was Bram Sable-Smith. He's WPR's Mike Simonson Memorial Investigative Reporting Fellow, also with Wisconsin Watch. We talked about his reporting on people with disabilities in Wisconsin who can't collect both Social Security disability insurance payments and regular unemployment when they lose their jobs. Wisconsin is just one of two states with that restriction. Coming up after the news, we'll talk about how President Trump has responded to protests following the death of George Floyd, and that includes a controversial photo op and a phone call with Floyd's family. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Still ahead, UW System President Ray Cross is asking for a special session in the legislature as our public universities deal with the effects of the coronavirus outbreak. We'll learn why and get the latest on the search to replace the system president. First, we're taking a look at the week in Washington. The big news this week, of course, is the response from the president and others in power to the protests and unrest following the killing of George Floyd. After a speech this week declaring his support for peaceful protesters, President Trump walked from the White House to an historic D.C. church for a photo opportunity. Before that could happen, though, authorities used tear gas and flashbang grenades to clear demonstrators from nearby Lafayette Square. The president also held a call with state governors where he called for them to control looting and vandalism with more military forces and by threatening long prison sentences for people taking part. You're part of this conversation. You can call 800-642-1234. What do you think of President Trump's leadership and rhetoric in the last week? Do you see it creating more division and increasing tension? Call 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. Our guest for this conversation is Aisha Roscoe. She's a White House reporter for NPR. Aisha, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
This photo op and the walk to the church were unexpected, pretty quick moving. Let's start with a listen to some of what the president said in his Rose Garden address just before leaving the White House grounds.
As we speak, I am dispatching thousands and thousands of heavily armed soldiers, military personnel, and law enforcement officers to stop the rioting, looting, vandalism, assaults, and the wanton destruction of property. we are putting everybody on warning. Our 7 o'clock curfew will be strictly enforced.
So after that, Aisha, what do we need to know about what happened?
Well, what happened next was at the very end of that speech, he said he was going to, you know, pay his respects at a very special place. And people didn't know what he was talking about. But it became clear that he was going to walk to St. John's Church, which is a historic church near the White House that has been used by, I believe, every president since Madison has gone to services there. But before he did that, law enforcement forcefully removed protesters from the area. The protesters were peaceful from all reports that you hear from people that were on the ground. This was a peaceful protest, and they were forcibly removed with flashbang, projectiles with, smoke and with some type of irritant that made people cough and choke. The White House is now saying it wasn't tear gas. Whatever it was, numerous reporters on the ground have said they were coughing and choking. And you could see it on TV. I mean, there were law enforcement mounted on horses, going at these protesters to get them out, including clergy from that church that were, passing out snacks to the protesters and speaking with the protesters. They were also forcibly removed from the grounds of the church. So President Trump could go out after this was all cleared. President Trump went to the church, stood in front of it. He didn't make remarks or anything like that, but he held up a Bible and he took pictures. And that has been the source of a lot of controversy and a lot of pushback.
Yeah, the president mentioned a 7 o'clock curfew being enforced in D.C. When did this happen? Was it after curfew?
So this was before curfew, and that was the other issue. So D.C., the mayor of D.C. had put in a 7 p.m. curfew where unless you were out on essential business, you were supposed to be off the streets. But this happened at like 6:30. This was before the curfew had even happened. I mean, I wasn't out there, but, I'm monitoring the speech and the, the kind of split screen of the protesters being pushed out. This was all happening before the curfew even went into place.
Yeah. And what do we know about how that walk and the photo op were arranged?
Well, there's been different reporting on how it all came together. It seems like this was the president this morning, President Trump, talking on another radio show. He said that this was something that he just decided to do. There have been some reports that maybe officials in the White House said that this would be a good show of strength for him. What President Trump said this morning is that he felt like it was symbolic. He says he didn't know about the people outside. He just told them he was going, and they just got it together for him to go. He didn't know about the people that were outside, but he felt that it was a symbolic moment and that it was important to do.
We're talking with Aisha Roscoe, who covers the White House for NPR, and we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. We've got Ron in Madison who wants to join the conversation. Hey, Ron.
Hi. I emailed you some descriptions of fascism, and it's clear that the current regime has been handling the past 10 days in a fascist manner. A definition I heard many decades ago explained that fascism is the combination of militarism and racism. It also made the trains run on time because it was a merger of big business and big government to help themselves.
Okay, Ron, thanks for that comment. Ron also told our call screener that he was concerned that it was confusing for people who are religious to see the president walk over, hold up a Bible, but not speak, that it was a manipulation. The president has come under this criticism for this from other places, too, right, Aisha?
Yes, absolutely. The Archbishop of Washington put out a statement yesterday that he felt, because the president also yesterday, this is after the photo op, which was earlier this week, he went to a shrine to former Pope John Paul II, and to lay a wreath. And so the Archbishop of the Archbishop of Washington, D.C., said basically that this was inappropriate for a Catholic facility to host President Trump after he had done what he did at St. John's, and that it was basically a manipulation, and that the former Pope would not have supported the president using force to force people out from nearby the White House to go for a photo op. And also the bishop of this church, St. John's, has raised concerns that he did not offer any, he held up the Bible, he did not pray, he didn't offer any condolences, and that this was not appropriate action on the part of President Trump.
So, Aisha, what have we heard then from Republicans in Congress? How are they responding to this?
A lot of Republicans in Congress seem to just not want to touch the issue very much. You had many Republicans, you could see when you looked at the statements, they said they hadn't really seen it. They didn't really want to comment. They were kind of acting like they do sometimes, or they were kind of behaving the way they behave sometimes when President Trump tweets something that's really inflammatory, where they say, I haven't seen the tweet. They were basically saying they hadn't seen the photo op. You did have Senator Tim Scott, who has raised concerns about President Trump's some of President Trump's statements about these protests in general. You did have him raising concerns about that. And you did have some raising some concerns about the idea of peaceful protesters being pushed out. But for the most part, you didn't really hear very loud voices from the Republican Party about this.
We now have Justin in Waukesha who's ready to talk with us. Hi, Justin.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Certainly. What are you thinking about when we have this discussion?
Well, everything I've heard from our president doesn't seem to be doing anything to de-escalate the situation, regardless of how you feel about the protests or the death of George Floyd. You would think our leadership should be making a point to do what they can to de-escalate what's going on and to minimize the amount of violence and protesting that turns into riots, whereas threats of military force and strict curfews with jail time, to me, is only going to be escalating the situation, causing more chaos. And really, I think we're going to see people trying to call his bluff.
Justin, thanks for that vantage point. Aisha, have you heard that sort of a concern that this is a lack of leadership and that his job should be to de-escalate right now?
That is absolutely a concern. And yesterday, this is after all of this happened at St. John's, where the protesters were pushed away. So this is a day after that. You had more protesters, it's hard to make crowd estimates, but some would say thousands of people who more than you would had before outside the White House once again and outside beyond the curfew. So breaking the curfew that was in place for D.C., which was 7 p.m. yesterday as a show. And many of those protesters were saying that they felt compelled to come out now because of what they saw with President Trump and because of President Trump's continual threats to bring in the military and use military force to kind of put down any rioting or anything like that, and just to use military force against American citizens.
We're talking with Aisha Roscoe, who is NPR White House reporter, about how President Trump has responded to the death of George Floyd and the protests that followed. You can still join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you approve of the president's leadership in the last week? What do you think that President Trump should be doing and saying in a time like this? What do you expect from people in Washington there to represent us? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. You can also email ideas@WPR. The conversation continues here on Central Time. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina, and we're talking with NPR White House reporter Aisha Roscoe about the week in Washington, specifically the president's response to protests and unrest following the death of George Floyd. And we're taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Mary Kay in Kenosha has given us a call. Hi, Mary Kay.
Hi, I'd like to comment on the protest that's going on in D.C. and the police chief. Have they walked and with the protesters? Has there been a prayer march with the reverends to honor George Floyd's memory, to de-escalate all this looting and everything?
Thanks for the question, Mary Kay. Aisha, what do we know about law enforcement and how they're interacting with protesters in D.C.?
I'm not sure exactly whether in any of the law enforcement in D.C. have marched with some of the protesters, but I know that clergy have gathered today in prayer and, you know, are assembling for peace. And I think that's what some of the clergy that were outside who ended up getting removed from the church grounds, that's part of what they were trying to do, was to talk to the because this was after the church basement. There was a fire set in the church basement. It seems like they were trying to talk to the protesters. They were trying to, you know, help them and feed them and provide water and medical assistance. And they were trying to be a bridge to the community. So we have seen clergy arranging marches or just times for people to come out and come together in prayer and in hopes for peace.
George Floyd's brother, Philonis, talked with MSNBC because President Trump called the Floyd family. And here's what Philonis had to say about that.
It was so fast. He didn't give me the opportunity to even speak. It was hard. I was trying to talk to him, but he just kept like pushing me off. Like, I don't want to hear what you're talking about. And I just told him I want justice. I said that I couldn't believe that they committed a modern day lynching in broad daylight. That's, I can't stand for that. Yeah. I can't. And it hurt me, you know? And it just, I just don't understand, man. Why we gotta go through this? Why we gotta have all this pain, man? I love my brother. I'm never gonna see him again.
Yeah, that's a really powerful statement. As a White House reporter, though, you hear George Floyd's brother and you hear President Trump, who has a distinctly different, memory or experience on that call. How do you make sense of that?
Well, I think that President Trump does often talk about this. He says he talked to the Floyd family. And, you know, says that this is not, you know, when he's talking about wanting to put down looting and things like that, that it he wants to do that because it dishonors Floyd's memory. But I was obviously hearing from the Floyd family, they're saying that when they talked to him, he didn't hear them or they didn't feel like he was listening. And this is an issue that President Trump has had. When he is dealing with families who have had loss in other instances where there have been complaints that they did not feel like President Trump listened to them and really heard them. And in this case, where they continue to talk about Floyd and his memory, and President Trump does talk about wanting justice for Floyd, what President Trump still doesn't talk about as much is how do you prevent there being more George Floyds? How do you prevent the systematic things that are happening and discrimination that happens and police brutality as a whole? And that is what people have not heard from the White House.
And I'm struck by just the similarities between that dissonance on that call and what protesters are saying they're showing up for to draw attention to, that people are speaking up, people who don't have the same privileges are speaking up, and the people who are privileged just aren't hearing them.
Yeah, and I think that obviously this is a president who, when it came to the protest in the NFL, he made that a political issue, and not just a political issue. He made it into this kind of cultural calling card for him that he was against Colin Kaepernick, who was kneeling against police brutality. And President Trump, you know, made this into a very big issue and pushed against that protest. And to everyone in the NFL that was protesting that way. And so this is an issue that this White House has had repeatedly, where they're trying to get these two messages. He's saying, President Trump is trying to say that he cares about what happened to Floyd, but these larger issues and the peaceful protests that we're trying to that have happened, he did not support. So there is a real disconnect.
We're talking with Aisha Roscoe, who is a White House reporter for NPR, and we are covering the president's response to the death of George Floyd and the unrest and protests that have followed. And Jeremiah from Fond du Lac wants to join our conversation. Hi, Jeremiah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Certainly. What's on your mind?
The whole presidency has been just horrible. It's divided us more than anything before. And as the remarks or lack thereof remarks of everything that's going on right now is it's ridiculous. He's not helping. He's dividing us more. It's just I'm beside myself, this whole thing.
All right. Jeremiah, I wonder, what do you think that there's something that the president could say right now that you would be able to accept and understand?
I don't think anything he says right now is going to fix anything that he's already said. He should keep his mouth shut, honestly. He should just not say anything.
Thanks for that, Jeremiah. And Aisha, different strategies here when it comes to what the president should weigh in on and when, because it is true that different people hear this president in different lights.
That is true. And there was debate on whether it was even, you know, worthwhile for him to give that speech in the Rose Garden, whether he should do it or not do it. I think the White House chose to do it because they wanted him to be seen and not they wanted him to look like he is in charge. But the problem, of course, is that whenever president, and he did give remarks in Florida over the weekend at a NASA event, more extensive remarks on George Floyd. The problem, of course, is that when President Trump speaks from a teleprompter, there's always a very difference than when he's tweeting. And the messages in the tweets often you hear about them more than the teleprompters, than what he says on the teleprompter, because it seems more consistent. And what you hear from President Trump in his tweets is stuff like when the looting starts, the shooting starts, and those type of statements, and talking about threatening to sic vicious dogs on protesters and ominous weapons. Those are the type of statements that stay with people. And it's hard to counteract that with a formal address when you're not going to be consistent in that message.
What about President Trump's call with state governors, including Tony Evers of Wisconsin? It was supposed to be about COVID-19 and how to respond to protests, and vandalism took up a lot of time. What should we know about that kind of that call and the pushback that some governors have?
Well, on that call, President Trump really, you know, went in talking about this idea that you need to dominate the streets, you need to be tough. He told the governors that if they didn't get tough, they would look like jerks. Those were his words, that they were, you know, that they weren't, they were weak. This idea that you need to bring the military in and crack down on protesters. And that's kind of what he brought, that same energy is what he brought to the Rose Garden, where he talked about bringing in the military. But today, the defense secretary, Mark Esper, actually said that he does not support bringing in the military at this point. He does not think it's necessary. So you see a divide even within the administration.
Sure. And then he and the governors, though, the federal government needs to work together with states to figure some of this out, because it's not going away.
And that's the other issue, is that the President Trump needs the governors to work together so that you can get solutions to this, and so that you can kind of bring to so that you these issues can be addressed. So it's probably not always the best idea to insult them and call them names. And there were governors, Governor Pritzker of Illinois did push back and say that he didn't like the president's rhetoric. And President Trump responded that he didn't like the governor's rhetoric. But that's part of the issue, too. You need to be able to work with governors to get these issues addressed, and insulting them probably doesn't help.
Aisha, lots going on. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Aisha Roscoe is a White House reporter for NPR. She joined us for a look at the week in Washington, and we've been talking about President Trump's response to protests and vandalism that followed the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis last week. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. We are thinking about community and schools as students wrap up a pretty crazy semester. And that brings us to the yearbook. Back in my day, yearbooks were kind of a middle school thing, and it became even bigger once you got to high school. But now even elementary schools have yearbooks to capture their experiences. And that brings us to Hadley Jo Lang. She and her service dog made it into the yearbook. Hadley Jo is 7. She has epilepsy, and she relies on her service dog, Ariel. Ariel, the dog, can sense when Hadley Jo is about to have a seizure so she can alert people to help. These two hop on the bus to school in Kentucky. They're together through lessons in the classroom and during dance and soccer practice. They're always together. And now there they are, side by side, in the kindergarten yearbook. When I look at those pictures closely, I'm pretty sure they're both smiling. So to everyone who is ending a radically different school year, teachers, students, administrators, aides, helpers, cooks, bus drivers, crossing guards, custodians, you made it. You matter. And summer vacation is closing in. I'm Keely Boltina. You're listening to Central Time, and this is the Ideas Network.
Live from NPR News, I'm Jack Spear. Minnesota's attorney general is upgrading the criminal charges against former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin in the death of George Floyd to second